Hey everyone, welcome. Welcome to another podcast episode of Navigating No Contact with Toxic Parents. I'm your host, Tracy Principe, and today I have a very special guest. I'm really excited to have this conversation and this deep dive with Carolyn Strawson. Carolyn is a narcissistic abuse expert, fellow somatic experiencing, first year. And you do IFS and brain spotting, and I'm going to let you take it over and before I mess it up.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me as well on your podcast. It's a real honor to be here with a subject that I know we're both extremely passionate about. So, I'm a trauma-informed therapist and coach, and really I use a real integration of things together, really from my own personal healing journey, from being in a narcissistic marriage and really realizing that as much as I kept trying to say I am good enough and I can do this, I really realized that that trauma of narcissistic abuse was really locked in my body. And that kind of brought me to the somatic work, then the brain spotting EMDR, somatic experience. Obviously, I've just started training in that too. But I also bring together things like positive psychology, which a lot of people think, how can you bring positive psychology into narcissistic abuse? We have a term in positive psychology called post-traumatic growth. And I'm a big believer that whatever depth we get to, and believe me, I know we can get to really deep depths because I have been at those deepest, darkest depths. But actually, because of that trauma that I went through, I now know I'm living actually an even better life. And we call this post-traumatic growth in positive psychology. So I help people really dive deep to understand, you know, have that psych education, really that nervous system education, why we feel the way that we do, and really look at that root cause resolution. You know, why do we end up in those narcissistic relationships? And that's not to say we're not kind of saying it's not the narcissist's fault, so to speak, because abuse is abuse and there is no excuse for it. But actually, for us to heal, it's not about changing the narcissist, whoever the narcissist is. It's about understanding, why do we feel the way we do when the narcissist is that way? What are the dynamics that lead up to all of that? Something I'm super passionate about, because I know it can be a very dark, lonely place filled with shame, guilt, and a lot of judgment as well. Not just judgment to yourself, but judgment from others too.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. So that's a really good point. Maybe we can expand on that a little bit more. Why do we feel the way that we do? When this is happening. Can you expand on that a little bit more?
When we feel the way we do, this is a lot to do with our nervous system. In fact, our autonomic nervous system. So when someone behaves in a certain way, and then we might start to get maybe a rapid heart rate, picking at our skin, our jaw tense and our shoulders, we might get really angry, or we might even feel like we're having this out of body experience and we're numbing out, we're switching off, we're going into shutdown. These are all really trauma responses, sort of a fight, flight and freeze. So fight, flight is kind of that angry, anxious, we're, you know, mobilizing more energy in our body, we're producing more cortisol. And then if we still perceive danger, we'll shift into that freeze where we shut down, we feel tired, exhausted, we don't have any energy. So when we're in that relationship with a narcissist, for instance, we feel the way we do with their behavior because we're perceiving their behavior to be dangerous. Now, that's not to say if there's like physical abuse involved and there's life threat, then yes, absolutely, we do need to react in that way.
Yeah.
Actually, very often with a narcissist, it's words. It's the words that they are saying. So why is it someone then perceives the words a narcissist says as dangerous to us? Why is that perception of that? You know, and for that, really, for us to understand, we normally have to go back to our childhood. You know, what is it about this relationship we have as an adult then that we're perceiving this to be dangerous and we're going into those trauma responses? And that's then really what is locked in our body, that trauma that's locked in our body, because it's not the narcissist making us feel the way we do. It's what we're saying to ourselves about the narcissist. You know, I'm not good enough. I'm worthless. I'm not important. I'm unlovable. All of those elements. And that could be really painful, taking us back to childhood when we may have felt like that. And again, the brain's number one job is to keep us alive, safe, and in the least amount of pain. So if you have a childhood experience where something's happened and as a kid you need a reason for that and you think, oh my God, you know, my dad's not praising me or behaving like this because I'm not good enough, that can feel really painful to a child. And the brain kind of goes, oh, this is really painful. Right, we don't want to feel like this again. So with that then is these patterns then where every single time we start to feel like that if by somebody's behavior, because it's recognize and what we know and it's familiar, our body will go, oh, this is dangerous again, don't want to feel this pain again, and there we go, like freeze again. So actually those adult relationships we're having when we feel a certain way, it's very much linked then to what has happened to us in our childhood and what we've interpreted those experiences as, that have created these inner child wounds, that becomes our brain's job. Nope, don't want to feel those, they're too painful, we're going to do everything we can. And I know both you and I do IFS, so parts work, and that's where all your protective parts are going to be showing up then to try and get you away from feeling them.
That's right. And I think and then touching on, you know, what the patterns that we go into when we feel that could be fix it mode, right? Fixing, pleasing. Can you talk a little bit about what that might look like? Because sometimes people don't realize, you know, those responses to that.
Yeah, because, you know, a lot of people think, gosh, if you're trying to fix things and please things, what a wonderful person. And that's not to say you're not. It's a bad thing to do that. It's the intention behind that. You know, if you start trying to please somebody because the intention is I need to please them because I need something back from them. You know, if I please the narcissist, then they're going to be nice to me. They're going to dial down their behavior to me. You're doing it then blended with this protector part, really, because that pleasing is looking for that external validation. So really when we have behaviors that show up, or protector parts really, when we're not living as ourselves, what we're looking at is what's the intention of that. And very often the intention is so we don't feel something else. And certainly when you're some of the key protector parts when, you know, with a narcissist is going to be things like people pleasing, perfectionism, procrastination. You know, there's some really key parts that will show up because that person, that individual who does find themselves in relationship with a narcissist and in those types of environment very much come from needing that external validation, or what we could kind of label it dependency then as well, you know, that lack of self-love. So because I don't love myself, I need you to love myself so that I can feel better in my system.
That's so true. And so when people find themselves in these kinds of relationships, sometimes it can be really, really subtle, right? It's not necessarily outward verbal abuse or physical abuse. Oftentimes, in fact, it's none of that, right? It's a really subtle
It's really form.
What might that look like? Because that's even hard to recognize.
It is really hard to recognize. And I can so relate to that, Tracy. You know, I was married for 12 years. We were together over 14 years. And I like to consider an intelligent woman, and I didn't even realize when I came out of my marriage I'd been in this narcissistic, psychologically abusive relationship. I was questioning myself at rock bottom. I really thought it was my fault, and I was really not in a good place whatsoever. And so for me, coming out of that, not even recognizing that, I know there are millions of other men and women in exactly the same situation, because it doesn't happen overnight. It's not this light switch where their behavior one day is lovely and nice, and then the next day it's like abuse. It doesn't quite happen like narcissists. You know, it is very subtle, it is very insidious, and And really, it's those moments where you start to question yourself, you know, those mm-hmm. times where you might ask a question about something because something doesn't quite feel right, and you might get shouted down, or they might not answer the question you are asking, but talk to you about the manner in which you are asking, things like, oh, you're not that again, or oh, you're so sensitive. So they're not actually answering the question, you know. And certainly in my marriage, Tracy, there was many, many times where my gut was kind of saying that doesn't seem right. So I'd actually ask, and he would look me in the eye and tell me these things. And inside I kept thinking, no, that can't be true. But I'd got my husband looking me in the eye saying, no, that is not true. So I could either call him a liar and then the abuse would escalate, or I could almost numb out, dissociate, not say anything to keep the peace. And then I start to think, well, maybe it is me, maybe I am too sensitive, maybe I am the crazy one, maybe it didn't really happen then as well. And this just really set you on that cycle, really, of most people who are in a narcissistic relationship will probably tend to end up being stuck in freeze, you know, that freeze response, shutdown, survival mode, just trying to get through. And that doesn't mean they're weak. It doesn't mean that they are, you know, lazy because they're not leaving, because people could obviously say, well, just leave then. It's because it feels safer to their system to stay and to be in freeze. You know, and it doesn't mean that when it feels safer, they won't do something. You know, that's how our nervous system works. We never give up what our system thinks is safest for us in those moments. But it's those little subtle shifts over those periods of time. You know, there might be some silent treatment even. There might be shouting. There might be words said. There might be, you know, hiding things. Questioning, you know, coercive behavior, manipulation, but it can all be really subtle. I remember having a client one day, and she came to me and she'd written down three sides of A4 paper of sentences that her partner had said to her over the years. And if you put some of them in isolation, you could kind of say, maybe he was tired that day, or maybe he was having a bad day and stuff. But when you've all written down, and this was a regular basis, this is abuse. You know, we all have bad days, grumpy now and again, and we, you know, do, you know, we all do. But when it's in all aspects of life, pretty much on a daily basis, you know, this is when it starts to form an abusive relationship then. So, and it can be very hard to spot, because you're married or you're in that relationship, for instance, and they're behaving a certain way. And this was the same for me, Tracy. You know, on a deep level, I knew the relationship wasn't right. But what would I do? I was reliant on my husband financially at the time. We've got two children together. We'd got a home together. What I leave, I take the kids, I've got no money, what do I do? You know, so there was all of it. It isn't just that, there's this whole kind of element around that where you just feel stuck and you kind of feel, well, I'm just existing, I'm not living a life, I'm just stuck in functional freeze doing what I need to do as a mom, and just really stuck, and it just feels like you're on Groundhog Day every day, you know. You're always trying to stay safe and protect yourself then, and really for me at stage, my only sense of worth was being a mum. So I just threw myself into being the best mum I could be, because at least then I had some semblance of worthiness.
That's really deep. Thank you for sharing that. Really powerful too, because it is that feeling that typically gets louder and can't be ignored. Is that how did you eventually, you know, get out of that marriage?
So it wasn't even me that left. It was him. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm sure at some stage, I mean, I always say there's three ways you leave a narcissistic relationship. So, you know, someone who's married or in that relationship, three ways. One, they leave, which is what would happen to me. He got another supply, one of many. This particular one, obviously, he decided to leave. The other is you managed to crawl away. Somehow you managed to crawl away. And the third is you actually die in the relationship. Now, that can either be you stay in it forever more till you're 80, 90, 100 years old, or as I've seen as well from, because I've had parents of children who have committed suicide from being in those types of relationships too. So, you know, they're kind of the three ways if once you're in that relationship to kind of. So for me, you know, I remember it like yesterday. You know, it hadn't been great for a very, very long time. And I remember him saying, you know, I'm going to leave. And normally I'd kind of not believe it or anything else. And on this particular day, I kind of said, yeah, you are. I said, but you need to tell the children this time. And I just remember when my daughter was asleep, she was young at the time, and my son was 6 at the time. And he took sort of 5 minutes to tell our son, you know, I'm leaving, and left. And just kind of left me with the carnage of everything then to pick the pieces up. So not only was I struggling with my own trauma of that, I still had to be a strong mom and I still had to look after my children. So, and that's that for me then is my days would then normally start trying not to have a panic attack. Sometimes I'd win, sometimes I'd lose. I was self-harming. So I was using the end of the toothpaste on top of my thighs. Because again, from a protector part IFS perspective, the pain of my thighs was a great distraction from the pain of feeling literally worthless from that too. So yeah, it was really, really rock bottom for a long, long time with that. And I've always said, if it wasn't for my children at that time, I wouldn't be here today. I was at a really low point.
Yeah, really low. Wow. Oh, wow.
Yeah, and just body, you know, when I look back and I think, you know, I was really bouncing between feeling really anxious all the time. So that was, you know, energy, I couldn't focus, you know, my brain fog. You know, a lot of people will say to me, you know, I get forgetful and that. Well, when you've been in an abusive relationship or indeed any type of trauma, you know, our amygdala in our limbic system, our fear center increases in size and our hippocampus, which is our memory center, shrinks. So, and it shrinks. And again, these are all physiological changes to protect us in these events. But that means when that hippocampus shrinks, we kind of forget things. We have brain fog and, you know, you kind of. And I remember if I'd used to sit, like once I'd put the children to bed in the evening, I'd kind of sit there and the TV would be on and I couldn't sit and relax. I'd sit there with the remote control. Kind of scrolling all of the time and flicking the channels. I couldn't read a book. I could read about 3 pages and I just couldn't focus. You know, my whole body was literally bouncing between fight and flight 1 minute and that energy. And then in 3 minutes, literally wanting to retreat, not see anybody, speak to anybody. And again, I know had it not been for the kids, I'd have definitely become agoraphobic. Mm. I really struggled to go outside of that front door. I could feel it all in my body.
Wow. Yeah. So lots of things going on with the nervous system and the body. Let me ask you your thoughts on this. So I have a lot of people that say, oh, I had a great childhood. So I don't know why I, you know, keep attracting narcissists.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I really relate to that. I was that person too. I was just thinking, I had a great childhood, you know, but it was only then when I came out of my marriage and I really started to look at it. I knew my dad was a challenging man in that he wasn't the most emotional, but my mom kind of really made up for that in some respect. So I kind of thought, you know, it wasn't that bad kind of thing. And it was only when I started to look really at the behavior and what maybe me as a child might have interpreted that, you know, my dad would never say, I love you. He'd never say I'm proud of you. I desperately tried to, you know, my dad's a real academic. So for me, you know, good grades at school and being a good girl and, you know, that academic, I was very sporty as well. So I literally did everything and I embraced everything and I was nice and all that, but I still never got that. I'm really proud of you, Caroline. Wow, well done. My mum, on the other hand, was very much her sense of worth came from being a mum. So the pressure for me to perform as well as a child to, you know, be this almost my learnt behaviour was being reliant on my mum to give her a sense of worth. So I kind of needed to stay a child because that gave my mum a sense of worth. So I've got my dad where I didn't feel good enough. I've got my mum where I had still stay being a kid almost, so she had that sense of worth for being a mom, and that dynamic, that kind of learned attachment feeling. My version of love with a man then was, you don't feel good enough, you don't feel like that was familiar, that was normal to me, and that's like a lot of relationships that I attracted. I just didn't ever feel good enough. And right. and of course, if they acted like I was good enough, I'd sabotage the relationship because it was like, well, this doesn't feel normal. This can't be right. This isn't That's love. Right. Right. Yeah, how crazy. But again, it wasn't familiar to me. You know, love right. to me with a man was I don't feel good enough and they behave yeah. in a certain way and I keep on trying and they never say anything back. That was the dynamic. So although That's I right. didn't necessarily have like that physical abuse or anything else, you know, trauma doesn't have to be these massive events that people think about, you know, childhood sexual abuse and things like that, which of right. course trauma, but trauma is really anything that is overwhelmed to your system where you interpret that to be pain, and that can then transcend into adulthood as well. So yeah. you know, this isn't to say, you know, all parents are bad, because most of them are always trying to do the best they can to their capabilities anyway, but say we just need to get curious about that then and really look at, well, okay, if my dad or my mom or my caregivers behave like that, or teachers or people at school, mm-hmm. how maybe would I have interpreted that as a child? It's very easy right. as adults cognitively to look back and think, no, that's okay, that was fine. It's really thinking, how would a child feel and interpret mm-hmm. that situation? Because it's often very, very different to what we see it as then as the adult. But what then, once it's locked in the body, unless we do right. That deep somatic work, it's still going to stay locked in the body.
That's right, yeah. Exactly. So, so important to understand that this really, you know, is that that familiarity is a body thing.
It's that attachment. You know, my attachment to my dad was very anxious. You know, that anxious attachment was what that feeling in my body of being mm-hmm. anxious, releasing cortisol, feeling like waiting for him to say something, that was my version of attachment. So that's what yeah. became my version of love. So then when I had those adult relationships, that's what my body wanted to feel like, because that felt normal, that felt familiar. And however much I might cognitively say to myself, no, 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 my body was overriding all of that and going, no, 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 this is what we want, this is what we need, this is normal. Right. Because if you had a childhood like this and this is what we know, even though it might not feel great, so to speak, mm-hmm. but at least you're alive, at least you're safe, and it thinks that's you're right. still in the amount of pain because that was your relationship with one of your caregivers and stuff too. So it was almost right. like my mom was highly codependent, my dad has got a lot of narcissistic traits as well. Mm-hmm. So that dynamic between the, you know, and I was the youngest of three too. So my two older sisters mm-hmm. were interpretations very different to mine on some of this element too. And then yeah. obviously the dynamic, you know, my middle sister was really poorly, she had a hole in her heart. So again, a lot of attention went to her. Mm-hmm. I was the youngest, about me kind of thing. So again, yeah. all of those dynamics, it doesn't mean, I think when people think about childhood, they think, was I fed, was I clothed, did right. they take me to school, did they do X, Y, and Z? And you know, on the whole, that is what most people do. But when we're really looking at that deep level, that security, that love, that attunement, yeah. that whole co-regulation, so that you feel right. safe in a self-regulate, you know, that all needs to come into it as well. And it doesn't mean if you don't get that they're bad people as parents. They're mm-hmm. parenting to how they were parented and stuff.
That's
too
right. Yeah,
down generations. But for me, it was about really recognizing, and I think about my mom, sadly passed away 10 years ago now, but both of my mom and dad, I feel so much love for them. But I also know they were human beings. I remember, Tracy, thinking, I think I must have been about 23 when I realized my parents were actually human. They were human beings. They weren't just mum and dad. They were actually human beings, fallible human beings who would make mistakes, who could be wrong. Because really up until the age of 23, I thought my mum and dad could do no wrong, be no wrong. Mm. Everything they said was right. Whatever they told me was 100% fact, everything.
Right.
Yeah. And I didn't realize that. And it was quite, and I remember actually thinking like, oh, you know, oh, I didn't actually like feeling like that they were real people, because that meant that they would make mistakes and things weren't right. And I'd really idolized my parents really for that. And you know, and, it, yeah. and again, that just made me think a little bit then, but it was up until my early 40s before I really did the inner work and really figured this stuff out.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's true for a lot of people, of, you know, yeah, thinking my parents, well, they were okay, or they weren't too bad, or, you know, I didn't really have, my childhood was okay, because I, you know, I grew up in a nice area and had food and clothes and all of those things. And then I really didn't realize something was seriously wrong until I looked at my adult relationships and the pattern that kept happening over and over again. And that thing about meeting, you know, nice guys, I used to say that they were boring.
I know. And a lot of the women I work with now, where they say, I think I'm ready for dating, I say, well, we need to make sure we're not going to sabotage any good relationships, because so many of the women that I work with will say, oh, do you know what? I was with this guy back at university or college, and he was so nice, and I don't know why stay with him. And I said, because it didn't feel normal to you to be in that relationship. Right. So of course you're going to sabotage it as well. You know, your whole system's like, oh, I don't know what this is. And just crazy how it works, but that's, you know, sadly our brain and our body's primary role is not for us to be happy or successful or wealthy or anything.
That's right.
Just to be alive and in the least amount of pain.
That's so true. Yes. So when people are coming out of these relationships, and I have, you know, I work on the side of, you know, the family of origin. And oftentimes when I do that work with clients, they will realize that their partnership is that same dynamic. Because again, they didn't see that before, and you know, it just really bleeds out into every area of your life, work, friendships, everywhere. So when they might come out of those types of dynamics and decide to go back to, you know, dating or partnerships again at some, you know, whatever journey point they're at with that, what are some things that they might keep in mind, you know, when they decide to, after a narcissistic relationship, a divorce, what would you say to those people that might think about dating, or the people that say, no, I am never getting into a relationship again? Because there's that side too, right?
And I think with that, Tracy, it's about, you know, owning your own power in all of this. You know, we all have a choice to make decisions as that adult in our relationships. But it's making sure, firstly, before we get back into that dating scene, we've done a lot of inner work as well. Yeah. You know, we've really worked on that root cause of why we were ending up in those relationships. Now, that still doesn't mean you may not date a narcissist, because you may not know. And you know, there's been research that says really it takes about 7 dates for you to really start to notice those red flags and narcissistic traits, you know, that you could really say, no. I do a really great exercise with my clients where I use these 5 buckets. So we have these 5 buckets on this sort of worksheet that we do together. And I get my clients to initially start to say, what are 10 key values for you that you would like to have if I was like your fairy godmother in a relationship? Mm-hmm. So we kind of list these 10 out, and these are kind of 10 that are the most important to that particular person. And this is going to be different for everybody. And then I say, out of those 10, let's narrow it down to 5. If you had to put those 5, which ones would you choose? So now we've got 5 key values that person really wants to have in the relationship. Then we list them in order. So we have 1 to 5, the most important down to the least for the 5th. And then I go through and I say, I want you to now tell me in the positive why these are so important. So for instance, let's say honesty is the top value, for instance. You often find that with people who have been with adulterers. Honesty is normally that top value. I want someone who's honest. So the time when I say to them, so why do you want to be with somebody who is honest in the positive? Probably 99% of my clients will go, I want to be with someone honest because I don't want them to cheat on me again, and I don't want to feel hurt. And I will always say, I hear you, I get that, but that's not in the positive. Why do you want to be with an someone, if you are with someone who is honest, how does that make you feel? What does it enable you to do? So we go through then, and the client really gets to know the five key values that are really important to them, because it makes them feel these different ways. And this can go down to ripple effects as being a parent in their job. It enables them to embrace life more, health, obviously, if you're with somebody like this. And then what we do is these five buckets. And I do three types of exercises with them. And we have the buckets where it's zero at the bottom, where it's empty, and 10 where it's a filled bucket. And I will go through and talk to them about when they first met their ex-partner, just before they split up from their ex-partner. And then the next one is, if they've started dating somebody, we'll do one there. But often it might just be two. And when we go through them, it's really interesting. The buckets at the start of a relationship, they're like, yeah, 8 or 9, or, you know, it's, and it's these same values. But what's really interesting, even at the start of that relationship, there's very often one bucket that will be like a 3 or a 4, like a 3 or a 4. So you might get, even at the start of the relationship, of their values, you might get 4, 8, 9 out of 10, but there's one that's maybe a 4 or a 5. And then when we keep on doing that towards the end of the relationship, they're pretty much all 0 or 1 on those values at the end. And then I'll say to my client, I'll say, we want a relationship for you where all five of these buckets are 8 or above. Mm. And the moment one of those buckets dips below 8, so you check in every date with this. You check in, okay, I've just had this date. It's my 4th date, for instance, with this man. Woman, and you go to your buckets and you go through your values and you check in. That moment you have one that goes below 8, we're curious. Is that a below an 8? Because maybe they've got something going on in their life, and at that point, maybe a parent is ill or there's something going on. There's a reason why their behavior is like that. But if we don't have the reason why and we have a bucket less than 8, then I've all of my clients, we do not stay in a relationship where one of those buckets is less than 8, because it might be okay to have 4 buckets that are 8 or above for a year, even 2 years sometimes. But at some stage, one of those being below 8, that is going to cause issues in your relationship at some stage. And that's where we have that power. So just as you said, from that dating perspective, this is about giving people tools. It's about empowering them to be in control of staying in a relationship or choosing not to stay in a relationship. But initially, the inner work has to come first.
Right. Yeah. Wow, that's really powerful.
Fun exercise to do with someone.
That sounds fun. I've never heard that done. Yeah, that sounds fun.
Yeah, because then that client starts to realize, like, you know, when we go through in the positive these five values, and it's like, you know, there is a person out there that can, that is like this. We now know what's really important to you. So now we know if you're dating someone and that isn't hitting those marks. And that's not to say, you know, that they may be not a nice person, but your top values are your top values. And if you're not with someone that's managing that, you're going to feel out of alignment, whether it's an abusive relationship or not.
Right. That's right. Absolutely. And that too is so important. I want to touch on is because when we come from those, attachment wounds and childhood homes that where maybe we were ignored or not valued, we don't even know, or our needs weren't being met, or we couldn't express our needs because something was happening in the home. We don't know what we need. We don't even know what we need, and we don't know, and we don't know how to ask for it, because that's dangerous and not safe, right?
We're kind of stuck as that little girl or little boy, really, you know, would a 5-year-old little girl in an adult relationship ask for something else? No, because that's going to feel scary, right? Just like you. So we may not say something there. So this is why when we say about trauma being trapped in the body, it literally is trapped in the body.
Yes.
But that you're safe all of the time. So, you know, we have to process that through the body so we can still look back at our childhood and know all of these things that have happened, but remember them, not keep reliving them in the present.
That's right. Yeah. And I find when my, you know, my clients, you know, start living in their body and come from that felt sense place, right? Their body comes alive and they're like, wow, wait a minute. They find their voice, they set boundaries.
Yeah, it's almost like, whoa, this is what life is like. This is what it's like to feel. We're living in this world of such busyness all of the time. And you know, with the work you do as well, Tracy, just giving someone space in a safe space, that client and therapist relationship, just to sit with those feelings and process them and validate them and feel them and close that process really of what it was like, so that you can start to move forward and get excited about the future and not so stuck in the present. Hear that word, I just feel stuck. Thing as that young child very often.
That's right. Yeah. So let me ask you this. I have people that I work with that, you know, they might still be in contact with their parents, and the parents are very toxic, you know, very enmeshed. They kind of come after them and bombard them and harass them. Or they might even still live with their parents, or they can't get away for whatever reason, similar to when you're in a relationship and for whatever reason, you currently cannot leave, financial, whatever, kids. And I know it's really hard to heal in that environment because your nervous system is just going to be hyper vigilant, right? Is there anything, any tips or, you know, strategies that you use when people can't currently get out of a situation like that?
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. It's very difficult to heal when you're still in that relationship. It's like, you know, recovering from a drug addiction, but walking around with an IV drip in your arm. But, you know, it's not going to happen. So really what we're looking at is symptom management at that stage. Just like you said, nervous system management. So we're looking at how can we stabilize how you are feeling. You know, the first thing is safety. So making sure you're safe in whatever environment you are in. That's the priority, actual safety.
Yes.
And then it's about just learning some, you know, techniques to regulate your nervous system, trying to be as present as possible. And I always say, if you're living in the house still with an narcissist, parents or partner, try and create a space in the home where we utilize all of the senses. You know, I often get my clients to create what I call a comfort box, where we put something in, you can smell, taste, see, feel, hear, you know, so that you can go to this space, even if it's a tiny little space, and you can just sit and engage those senses. Because every time you do that, you're bringing your body back to the present moment, you're bringing it back online, different part of the brain, and we're just calming that nervous system at that stage. It doesn't take away the situation you are in, but we want decisions as much as possible to be made in the front part of the brain, more logical and rational, rather than that emotional part of the brain in that nervous system dysregulatory aspect too. So it's just about creating those safer spaces within the household for you. Drinking an icy cold glass of water can really help get someone back online as well. Breathing can sometimes help, not all the time, because breathing can be more challenging, but on the whole, breathing can be really good. So extending that exhale by longer than you're inhaling, almost tricking the brain into knowing that you are. But just really simply, if you think about the five senses, it's a really simple way to do that and really slow it down. Engage those senses. And even if you could do that two or three times a day, even for 2 or 3 minutes, that's really going to help your nervous system to kind of, oh, okay, there is some safety. There is some safety. And even doing that, what we're doing is we're really telling our system that there's hope, because we can potentially feel like that. And in those moments, we might be able to start to think of a strategy of leaving or creating stronger boundaries. If it's parents, for instance. So it just allows us to start to make those tiny, tiny choices as such, little decisions, as opposed to being stuck. But a lot of it, when you're in it, is just about symptom management with that.
Yeah, absolutely. So important. And the other thing I noticed too is those circular conversations, which also jack up the, you know, the cortisol, because you end up defending yourself and going in this circle. Is it better to try to just do like the gray rock method, where you're just kind of like,
absolutely. You know, a lot of this is, and this is where people need to be kind to themselves as well. You know, trauma bonding is an addiction. You know, we kind of get, when they're nice to us, we get the dopamine, the oxytocin, and it feels good. But then in those moments when we're kind of in fight, flight, freeze, we're releasing more cortisol, adrenaline, norepinephrine, and we become addicted to those actual neurotransmitters, those hormones that we have in our body. Addicted to that. So, you know, it's very difficult, again, to say to someone, go gray rock in that situation when you're still in. Very often every cell is wanting to kind of validate. You need something from somebody. And I'd probably even do a step earlier and just try and work on the nervous system element first, because what I don't want is someone to feel like a failure then if they can't do gray rock, so to speak. Because it's not their fault, you know. Their system is going to do what it needs to do to stay safe. And we want to work with that. We want to try and make it a bit more flexible so we can then start to make those choices. Once we start moving beyond that, absolutely gray rock, no contact if you are able to do that, or extreme modified contact as well. That's going to really help then start that healing process.
Yeah, and I think that too, brings up another great point. When you leave, and I see this a lot, when you finally break free, that's oftentimes when the trauma really shows up.
Because you can
really get flooded with all of that.
Well, if you think, if the inner child wound is I'm not good enough, just as an example, you know, the inner relationship is like, well, breadcrumbs are better than nothing, right? At least I'm getting some breadcrumbs of love from a narcissist. All of a sudden, when you leave, or they leave you, and you have no one in that relationship, it's like, oh, I'm really not good enough now. And it's like, again, go back to those childhood wounds, danger, danger, danger. Literally go into those trauma responses then as well. And we can, like you say, our body with cortisol, we go into shutdown, you know, we might get angry or rageful, we might go and have a drink or whatever parts are going to show up in that scenario. And actually we need to be really careful in the first 7 days of leaving an abusive relationship. That's where the most homicides happen. So really, again, we've got to create that exit strategy before we even know. And that can take a long time even to create that, because those first 7 days, safety is priority in all of that.
It can really feel like death, right? And that's why people are going to go back.
Because it feels safer to stay, because breadcrumbs are better than nothing.
I see that a lot. So super important, and definitely having that support, if you are going to leave and have that time where things are really going to show up. Really powerful, important stuff. So as we wrap up here, is there anything that we didn't cover that you'd like to share or that you feel is important?
I think one of the key things for me when I talk about narcissistic abuse is that whoever is listening right now, if you can relate to anything that we've said, it is not your fault. There are reasons for this, but the power to heal is not in us knowing everything about a narcissist and getting a PhD in narcissism and hoping that there's something. The power to not feel the way you do right now is within you. And we just work in, like someone like you or myself, to really unlock all of that so you can then go and live your life. Because a narcissist won't change, you know, and very often we sit waiting for them to, and they won't. So the power to heal is in within you, not in changing the narcissist. And that's what we want to work on. We want to manage those symptoms in the present, go back and work on those inner child wounds, so you can go and have post-traumatic growth and actually lead an even better life because of what you have been through, which might seem impossible right now, but I'm living, it can happen. It absolutely can happen with the right support, you know, but it's not your fault.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really the, you know, that nervous system, that survival, those survival responses that a lot of people don't realize, you know, that's what's happening. And I know there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of talk about narcissism. There's a ton of YouTube videos and books and on and on and on. And that's great to have, but at some point that internal process with the nervous system,
into play.
Is really, I think, is going to be the key to breaking, you know, the what I see that's similar in the work, the parent, you know, starting with that family of origin, and
I agree.
Direct connecting those dots to the type of relationships that you might find yourself in. Wow. So powerful. So this has been really, really good. And I want to thank you for showing up today. Do you mind, you know, shouting out your website and where people can find you?
Yeah. So I've got my website, carolinestrawson.com, or come and follow me on Facebook or Instagram. I have a free group on Facebook, a free support group as well. So come and join that. Narcissistic abuse and trauma recovery for women. I do work with men on a one-to-one basis as well, but my Facebook group is women. So yeah, just reach out. I have my own podcast as well, the Narcissistic Trauma Recovery podcast. So, you know, just know you're not on your own. Know that you are heard, you're believed. You know, I certainly believe you. And I just want you to know basically that you're not on your own.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah. And that is really, because it can feel so lonely and isolating and a lot of shame.
Yeah.
Lots of shame. So yeah. Thanks again for being on my podcast. I'm so excited to share this information with my viewers. And just want to thank you again for coming today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me, Tracy.
All right.